I thought tonight I'd talk about a subject that I don't talk about enough of, and that's monastic training. We have a very, I don't know of anywhere that's quite like here, really. We have a meditation centre, and we're also a retreat centre, and we also offer monastic training. So there's a comprehensive array of different possibilities for people. I always feel slightly like in the monastic side of things, we're just underwhelming. Whereas the rest, you know, the opportunity for lay people, for people in the world who earn a living to come and practice the training is really, you know, we're fulfilling our potential and realizing, well, one of the things you have to do if you want something to happen, you have to speak it. You have to speak about it, and then people know it's possible. And you might be thinking, well, monastic training, that's got nothing to do with me. I live in the world. I pay my taxes and earn a living. I've got a family. I couldn't possibly come in for training. Absolutely, completely understand. But there's more to it than that, because anyone who comes along to the centre is met with a monastic community, a full-time community. And so having an understanding of how the monastic training works and what it's all about really helps to understand your place in the grand scheme of things. Also, essentially it's the same training. It's just a different focus, obviously. It's a concentrated form of training. But essentially it's the same teaching. Craving arises because of an ignorant grasping onto the world. And that causes suffering, and through following the Noble Eightfold Path, it's possible to resolve all the suffering. You know, so it's a training in ethics, in mental development, in order to develop wisdom into the true nature of reality. So that's the same whether you're a lay meditator or in the monastic community. Yes, I'm going to talk about myself in regards to my monastic training. It's not really about me, but I couldn't find another way of really going about explaining things. So forgive me for that, if it's a bit too much self-referencing. But I had a religious upbringing, and I could never put my finger on why, but I always felt a tremendous sense of discomfort with that. And it's only now in hindsight. And a lot of what I'm going to talk about this evening has clarity due to hindsight. At the time, I was just as confused as anyone else. And this whole training is staring into the unknown, isn't it? And some of the concepts are really out there, and I appreciate that. And it's only I'm only now talking with hindsight on after 17 years that I can sort of practicing this way, that I can sort of think clearly about it. But in hindsight, now I realize that I couldn't accept the religious ideology of just having faith in something that you couldn't prove. And when I discovered the Buddha's teaching, what I loved about it was that it could bear any degree of scrutiny. It was logically, had an internal consistency and logic to it. It was faultless in that regard. And most importantly, all the truths to which it pointed are discoverable. You don't have to wait. You don't have to prove your faith and win liberation that way. That you, by learning to pay exquisite mindful attention, you could come to understand the true nature of reality directly. And that for me was everything. On my voyage around life, and I hasten to add, a very unhappy young man, I found myself on a retreat elsewhere, contemplating right livelihood and how to ensure that my livelihood was right livelihood. I wasn't going to make a mistake, and the thought popped up, well, you could become a monk. That would ensure that, surely that has to be right livelihood, being a monk. I've since found out that there's right and wrong livelihood for a monk, but at the time it seemed, well, and then, you know how sometimes you get an idea and it just won't go away, and it just goes, oh, that's what I need to do. Yeah, the seed was sown and through just reflecting on things. And also you have to understand that to enter into a monastic community, there have to be certain conditions met with. You can't be wanted by the police. I was so boring that I wasn't even wanted by the police. You can't have disease. You can't have court appearances outstanding. You can't have dependents. If you've got dependents, then you have to look after them, and you can't come into full-time monastic training. And of course, I had none of these prohibiting circumstances, so it was possible for me to come in. And so it's not for everyone. But what I discovered when I came here was this amazing reciprocal arrangement, this beneficial arrangement between a lay community and a monastic community. So the monastic community looks after the centre, it looks after the retreats, it provides the necessary teaching, and in response, the lay community look after the material welfare of the monastic community and treat the monastic community with reverence and respect, which is absolutely in keeping with what the central premise of the Buddha's teaching is. Recognizing that to come in as a full-time monk or nun, that there was great responsibility in that, but also what it would give was just incredible space to practice the way. So here we have 5 hours of seated practice every day, and the monks and nuns and full-time community serve, so they work on behalf of the whole community in order to ensure that the community has the opportunity to benefit from the following the way, the training. This is entirely in keeping with the fundamental premise of the Buddha's teaching. When I was intending to come in, I think it was after I'd met Alan, but before I came in, somebody asked me whether I was joining a cult. And in hindsight, I think I was leaving a cult. And that cult is the cult of selfhood, which is a very well-established cult. Most people will not even consider the possibility that the fundamental root cause of their problem in life, their sense of dissatisfaction, their sense of separation, their sense of never having quite enough, the sense of feeling that there is something missing, and then all the craving and the suffering that arises out of that sense of division, is all based on a fundamental belief in something which doesn't exist. I did say that there are some aspects of the Buddhist teaching which appear on first sight to be out there. But in order to clear that up at least a little bit, just to help settle a few nerves, consider when we're at our most self-conscious, how does life flow? Does it flow? Or does it feel stilted, awkward, and uncomfortable? And those times where there's an absence of self-concern, how does life flow? When you're absorbed in the other, when you're not self-referring, but you're just absorbed in life, how does life flow then? Does it flow easily, without much difficulty and problem? And so when you actually start to consider it, even on the intellectual level, you begin to get a sense that perhaps maybe there is something to this, as outlandish as it might at first appear. The reason I'm pointing that out is that the monastic training is all about letting go of self-centeredness. This whole training, whether you're a layperson or a monastic, is about letting go of self-centeredness. Again, perhaps consider what happens in meditation when we're caught up in hindrances and we're preoccupied with our neurotic thoughts and our sense of dissatisfaction, and we're pushing and pulling and wanting life to be different than it is. Who is the central character in all those narratives if it's not the self? Because it is the self. It's the central character in all our sense of dissatisfaction and all our cravings and wanting life to be different than it is. The whole emphasis of the training, whether lay or full time, is in letting go of self-centeredness and self-concern and developing the opposites. So everything that I'm now going to talk about has in some way that as its fundamental premise. So for instance, my first experience of the centre was, well, firstly it was reading Alan James's book, The Unfolding of Wisdom, which was exactly what I needed to read and at exactly the right time. And so I plucked up the courage to come and meet Alan. Not only had I never heard of Alan James or the House of Inner Tranquility, I'd never heard of Bradford and Avon. Jumped on the train from Bristol and came over, came up the hill and was introduced to Alan, and we had a very good conversation. And it's an incredible thing to discover somebody who actually knows you better than you know yourself. And it was an astonishing experience to find that I was able to tell him what the problem was, why I was so unhappy, in a way that I'd never been able to tell anyone else in my life, and to have that person ratify and confirm that actually he did actually understand and I was on the right lines. And then my first test of my self-centeredness arose, because it had been fine up until that point. And I'd asked him if I could come in for full-time training, and he said yes. And then he said, you know, we're not a vegetarian organisation, don't we? And I'd been a vegetarian for 15 years. And that was my first test. Alan wasn't testing me. He was just explaining how things were done here. But it was my test because it was the view that I had decided, I had chosen to keep, to hold on to. And in that moment, I said, I make that view up. I decided to keep to that policy, I don't need to. And coming in for training is vastly more important than hanging on to my views. My views had not brought me any happiness. I think Alan was pleased, and in hindsight, we've discussed that. He said that he knew in that moment that I was trainable, that I was amenable to guidance. And that's what we're talking about when we're saying letting go of self-concern. So even, you know, it's the same with coming on retreats. Some people are used to sitting cross-legged. Some people are used to going on a retreat where they do things in a different way. Whatever it is, it's letting go of the self-centeredness and being amenable to guidance. Because we always come back to this, and the relationship with the teacher is so important. The guidance is being offered for you to go and discover whether the guidance actually works. It's not telling you what you should believe or how you should live your life. It's giving you the tools that you can actually go and discover things for yourself. Anyone who's coming in for training, and especially monastic training, is confirming that indeed they do not know and do not understand how life works. If you knew and understood how life works, you wouldn't have to accept any guidance. So there's absolutely no point in complaining or fighting with the teacher. Rather, it's about becoming adaptable, accepting guidance, and putting the guidance into practice and finding out through experience what happens. So the teacher is a surrogate. When we come to a spiritual training, we don't actually know how to properly listen to life. And our attempts to listen carefully and observe life carefully to see its true nature is warped, distorted, and mangled because of our self-centered attitudes. The teacher's role is to be a surrogate, temporarily giving a human face to the true nature of life. So the teacher helps guide, because in our confusion we don't know the wood from the trees. And through experience we grow in confidence that the teacher actually does have our best interests at heart and wants us to find things out for ourselves. But you can only discover that if you're willing at first to have the faith to say, all right, well, I'll accept this person's guidance and find out what happens. But the teacher's role is only, it's only a surrogate. It's only getting you to the point where your spiritual faculties are so mature that you can actually listen to what life's been telling you the whole time and finally not ignore it and finally accept the self-evident evidence which is all around us, because that's what the teaching's all about. So yes, so when someone comes into full-time training, they have this tremendous opportunity. They're given so much time to actually develop their mindfulness in the best possible supporting conditions. But they also have to live life in a certain way. So just as lay meditators have 5 precepts that they keep as part of the training, full-time monastics have a whole set of rules that they need to abide by, which have various functions, all of which are fundamentally to do with letting go of self-centered attitudes. They're all about how you behave, the way that you behave. And the idea is that you cannot possibly keep all the rules all the time. It's not that you're given carte blanche to just break any rule you like. But the point being that one of the reasons for the rules is that it keeps the reputation of the order on a good footing. Full-time monastics have to be worth supporting by lay people. If they're behaving in ways which are inappropriate for that support will be withdrawn, quite understandably and quite correctly. So they have a responsibility to behave as proper monastics should. Also, keeping the rules is extremely good for helping develop your mindfulness. When I arrived here, there was a great emphasis on impeccability. Impeccability in terms of the way that you behave, but also impeccability in terms of the way that you treat your environment. So it's developing a sense of love and reverence for all things and treating all things with respect. One of the first tasks that I was given when I came in, and remember I was a early 30s bachelor who still didn't have a clue about how life worked. So I was given houseplants to try to keep alive, which I did successfully. So I had to learn when to water them, how much was the right amount, when to leave them, and all this kind of thing. So it was developing me a sense of love. Also, the rules cannot be kept perfectly. And so once a month, what happens is the monastics come together on a full moon. They go through all the rules and read them together. And then the most senior recluse then hears any breakages of rules. So what you do is you keep a note throughout the month of the rules that you've broken. And then you confess to breaking the rules. And if there is any admonishment or any advice that the senior recluse needs to give, that advice is given. And then most importantly, what happens is that the paper on which all these breakages of rules are given is ripped up and thrown away. And the point being that it's all transient. That opening up and being honest about what's really taken place is absolutely essential for the development of mindfulness and for the letting go of self-concern. For all monastics, there will be something that they'll find very, very difficult to let go of. I had mine. I was caught out in a lie. And I didn't, for whatever reason, I didn't want to confess it. But I was told that I had to, and I got through it, and I confessed it, and it turned out it was fine. That's what the training is all about. It's about learning to let go of self-concern. So that's another reason why the rules are there. Another aspect of self-concern that I immediately remember is my mentality is I'm on the greedy side rather than the hateful side. So I am conscious of my appearance. It's one of the aspects of the personality of a greedy type. I was fine wearing the uniform around the place because everyone understood what it was, and you know, that's fine. But if I had to go on an errand to Trowbridge or something like that, or be in public, I would find it extremely embarrassing. And what would happen is my mentality would be such that I would draw attention to myself. So I was far more likely to get comments. Okay, and I found getting those comments really, really challenging sometimes. And each time I complained about it to my teacher, he would always say, "What were you thinking?" And he meant it. He meant, at that time, what were you thinking? And it would always be a form of resistance. It would always be a form of, "Oh, I wish this wasn't happening. I wish I wasn't going through this." And that's obviously what was drawing the attention. So in the end, I was on some errand to Trowbridge, and I let go, and to hell with it, whatever comment I get. And from that day onwards, I never ever got a comment, because nobody noticed me. Because whatever I was doing on the mental level was no longer being broadcast. So, I learned a lot from that. But things like the uniform, it's like, yes, it's an act of renunciation, letting go of self-concern, but also it's a demonstration of fewness of wishes. You just got your clothes to wear for the day, it's exactly the same as yesterday, exactly the same tomorrow, it's fine. And so you develop contentment with little, fewness of wishes. So the system works fabulously well. And obviously, of course, making the uniforms is an opportunity for service on the part of lay people for the monastics. So that's a really lovely thing to do. The whole process is about letting go of self-centered attitudes, letting go of cravings. So another example of that is like the hierarchy of tasks that inevitably we all individually place tasks in various degrees of, well, how much status do they actually have? So obviously talking the tummo will have, you know, high status, and sweeping out front will have low status. And one of the beautiful things about practicing mindfulness is the discovery that it actually didn't matter which task you were given to do, because if you're breaking everything down into the component parts, which is what mindfulness is all about, and noting and being with experiences, you discover that there are only just an endless series of actions that we perform, endless series of components that go to make up any experience. So if you deconstruct it in that way, you realize, well, it really doesn't matter what you're doing. It makes absolutely no difference. And what's that lead to? A reduction in self-centered attitudes and a freedom from craving to be given one task or another task. In all of this, the recluse doesn't have a choice, you see. They're given tasks to do, and the whole idea is about letting go, giving up, surrendering. So, and the effect of all that, if you start to bring it all together, is what happens when you sit down to meditate. And there are 5 separate hours of meditation per day, and you can learn an awful lot with that degree of involvement with meditation. And everything that we talked about so far is developing conditions in such a way that you can sit down with a minimum of self-centered mental attitude. So the idea being that it should be, therefore, with practice, should be easier to put hindrances aside. And if it's then easier to put hindrances aside, it's then easier to practice different forms of meditation, like loving kindness, recollections, and so forth. And of course, insight meditation. I remember distinctly the moment I realized that it would be possible to undertake the whole of the Vipassana training, and that was a point after a few months when I was sitting in meditation and there were no hindrances. And I realized that what I was being asked to do was actually fundamentally very, very simple. I'm not saying it was easy, I'm saying it's simple. All I was being asked to do was just attend to whatever arose in my experience at that moment and note it, whether it was a thought, a feeling, a sound, a tactile sensation, a perception, whatever it was that I became, irritation, envy, tranquility, peace, happiness, whatever it was being experienced at that time, my responsibility as a recluse was just to note exactly that. Now, it's not easy to do because you have to get the mind, the culture of the mind, to a certain place where it is possible to do that, and that's what the rest of the monastic training is geared towards. So think of it as a pyramid, the training as a pyramid. You just want to get to the point where you're at the peak of that pyramid, where you're able to just wisely attend to the true nature of your experience. And so that's where the progress of insight, vipassana, really, really took hold. And somebody asked me about my teaching style recently and why I go on about things like football and watching sci-fi movies and liking Radiohead and all this kind of thing. I think partly the point is that I want to give everyone the impression that, blimey, if Paul can, I can. Yeah. That you don't have to be a superstar. One of the problems that I think Alan and Jackie encountered was that they were put on such a high pedestal by people that came along that it became almost an impossible dream to realize the cessation of suffering, that entering into that aspect of the training wasn't really doable. And if I want to put anything across, is that, well, if I can, anyone can. You don't have to be special. You don't have to be a superstar. You've just got to do whatever you can to deal with the self-centered nature of the mind enough that you can put everything to one side and just focus on paying attention to your conscious experience and just deconstructing mentally, just putting everything into their right categories, just observing all these different components. And through that comes the recognition that everything is indeed arising and passing away due to conditions, that there is no solid, no component that passes through time. There is nothing that is set. It's all arising and passing away, and therefore there is nothing to grasp onto, there is nothing to hold, there is nothing to identify with as being self. And yet the whole flux of experience happens, and the whole of life is constructed from moment by moment without the need of any self anywhere in that whole process. And again, this is discoverable. This is not a matter of just believing it because somebody says it. You can actually discover this for yourself. And I know that there are objections to that. One objection is that, well, if all these things are arising and passing away, well, that's just saying that the self changes. The self is changeable. Well, then you have to ask yourself, if the self is changeable, if the self can change, how do you know it's still the self? If it's the self, there has to be some component that remains clearly recognizable as being the self. If it changes to such a degree where it's not recognizable, then how do you know it's still the self? Okay. And what do we examine when we practice vipassana? We examine everything arises due to conditions. Nothing remains for more than a moment. There's nothing which has that aspect to it, that it does not change. And yet the whole of life unfolds perfectly spontaneously, perfectly reasonably. And so somebody might then complain or suggest that, well, the self is something which is behind all of that, but it cannot be perceived by our limited human mind. In which case, how do you know it's there? All you can possibly have is simply a blind belief in the theory of self, but still you can't actually find it. It's an absolutely incredible journey to undertake. And you discover through undertaking it that you come to understand how life works, how experience unfolds, how existence comes to be and passes away moment by moment. It is truly profound. There's nothing like it So it's all pointing towards letting go of identification, letting go of the insistence of there being an owner or controller of events. As you let go of all that self-centered, those self-centered attitudes, you find that life smooths out tremendously. Because you're not craving for it to be different, you're not identifying with things, so experience is allowed to unfold spontaneously. And you find that life smooths out tremendously, and it's a great joy. In the end, I discovered that there was one final bastion of self-centeredness in my training. I'd gone through the entire Vipassana path and had come out the other end. And I was going to see my teacher, Alan, on a regular basis. And he'd always start with a question such as, what is it that you do that an enlightened being would never do? What's the difference between you and an enlightened being? And of course, I couldn't possibly answer that. See, I'd looked through absolutely every component part of experience. I'd looked at everything, and I saw that everything arises and passes away due to conditions. There is no component part that passes through experience. Everything that I was reporting to myself was saying, you understand, but still the question was arising, well, do I understand? Is this enlightenment? My teacher was throwing me these questions, not because he wanted an answer, but that he wanted to get me to stop asking the question. So I was kept on asking the question, is this enlightenment? I couldn't leave it alone. Why couldn't I leave it alone? Because I wanted to become enlightened. It was the final bastion of the theory of self. And so it finally came so that before one meditation, I was reading in the Pali Canon, a particular sutta, where the Buddha states, it's a bit technical, but he states, the monk sets his mind up ready for what's called the destruction of the kankas, but he sets his mind up ready, was what I needed to hear. Because I was still trying to make something happen. I was still trying to work something out. But now I realized all I had to do was to set the mind up. And that was the last thing to do, that I could not make anything happen. So it's the last bastion of control, the last bastion of trying to make life different than it is. And so I came, sat down, I was taking the meditation, and I just rested the mind and just let phenomena arise and pass away without attempting to do anything at all. So the last key in the puzzle of following the spiritual training is to give up the idea of enlightenment itself. And once I'd given up the idea of enlightenment, all that was left was the peace of life unfolding rightly. So that's what monastic training gave me. But it didn't give it to me, obviously. So it's this absolutely wonderful way of following the spiritual training. It's not for everyone, obviously, but it's well worth either entertaining the idea if you have the right conditions that allow it, or just getting behind a monastic community and supporting them and generating all kinds of incredible merit and good karma in the process.